It's the mid to late 1800s, and Britain is fascinated with the apparent extinction of the Tasmanian Aborigines. Well, it confirmed the superiority of the Brits, and it coincided with a ghoulish appetite for human remains. And while there was some regret about the passing of the people, it was framed in the context of the loss to science and to anthropology, rather than an acknowledgement that a culture of value had been lost, or a mourning for a massive loss of lives. Now, in this climate, Ernest Westlake, a Quaker of modest means but an inquiring mind, was funding a passion for collecting. He collected thousands of stone tools in Hampshire and then thousands more in France, and these stone tools, he believed, were eoliths. That's a term used for tools from the pre-Paleolithic era. And to prove his point, or in the hope of proving it, he travels all the way to Tasmania to find similar tools used by the Tasmanian Aborigines that he believed would be a match for his pre-Paleolithic tribes of France. So he takes off to Tassie with a bicycle and a tent and gathers around 13,000 stone tools that he shipped back to France. But my guest was not so interested in his stone tools, but in his field diaries and letters. And she joined us on the blower from Melbourne to tell us what she found. Dr. Rebe Taylor, historian and author of the book Into the Heart of Tasmania, published by Melbourne University Press. Rebe, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you.
Let's paint a picture of Ernest Westlake, if you don't mind. Quaker, middle class.
Yes, he was born in a little village called Fording Bridge in 1855 on the edge of the New Forest in Hampshire. He was the son of a very conservative Quaker evangelical father who ran a local mill and was very prosperous. And Ernest Westlake's mother died when he was 18 months old of tuberculosis. And although his father married again, he didn't have any other children. And Ernest Westlake remembers his childhood as being a very solitary existence, very sombre. It was a sin to smile.
Absolutely right. I never approve of smiling. Now, Ernest might have been good at collecting rocks, but he wasn't very good at keeping money. Apparently, he blew the family fortune.
Yes, I think that was recognised quite early in his childhood. His father, who was himself an amateur scientist and astronomer, sent his son to university to study science and did so partly knowing that he didn't really have an aptitude or interest in science. He was a very dreamy young boy, quite introverted, and had a very strong interest in nature and science. And as a young man, Ernest Westlake goes to live in Bloomsbury, in the intellectual heart of London, and is part of that first generation in the 1870s to come into contact with the ideas that were later known as the Darwinian Revolution.
Now, where many geologists and anthropologists of his era preferred to stay at home, he throws his leg over a bicycle.
Yes, interestingly, as a young man, very uncomfortable at home with his father's ideas and living there nonetheless as a bachelor, he comes into contact in the New Forest with a community of quite eccentric upper-class people who are venturing into ideas of vegetarianism and anti-vaccinationism and spiritualism, and also interested in riding bicycles and
this is wonderful stuff.
Driving gypsy caravans was another fashion. You know, these are people with utopian ideals, and he's much younger than them, and he's middle class, but and not upper class, but very susceptible to these ideas, and they welcome him because they share this interest in collecting stone tools, and also they decide to start up a Hampshire Psychical Society, that is to look into the phenomenon of spirits. So open to these ideas, the young Ernest Westlake is restless. He's passionate about discovering and exploring human cultural evolution. And yes, he starts in Hampshire. He goes across Europe. He's looking to understand the formation of Europe while it was still covered in oceans. Through this long bachelorhood, he eventually marries another Quaker woman. Unfortunately, 10 years later, he has not only lost the family fortune by investing in a family company that was completely corrupt, it's not entirely his fault, he also loses his wife, who dies, unfortunately, very suddenly. And he's left with two very young children, no money. But this doesn't stop him. He goes back into the field looking for the eoliths you mentioned earlier.
Okay, let's look at eoliths. I've got quite a sizable collection from them, but they're a bit problematic because it's hard to tell an eolith from just a piece of broken rock.
Well, that's because there is no difference. An eolith was, from its first so-called discovery, controversial. People in Europe understood that humans had evolved through the transmutation of species. So they were looking for the missing link. They were looking for that ancestral journey right back through the cultural evolutionary steps. And eoliths filled that gap. Some advocates believed they have found stone implements of human ancestors dating back more than 20 million years. But the skeptics outnumbered those who believed that and said, really, you can create an eolith by stamping on a rock pretty hard or rolling a cartwheel over it. And the response was, but yes, because eoliths were made by primitives so backward that they couldn't even intentionally design something. So it was very hard to win the argument. Ernest Westlake thought, and he wasn't alone in thinking this, that by comparing them to Tasmanian stone tools, that you would find two cultures of the same evolutionary status.
Of course, at the time, there was a fascination with Tasmania. And the sad fact that British colonisation seemed to have resulted in the extinction of a race.
That's right. And the two ideas have a kind of close relationship. So when human antiquity is discovered in Europe, very quickly afterwards, anthropologists argue that to look to the Tasmanians is to see a parallel society that was at the very beginnings of Paleolithic Europe.
I think we should make the point that he didn't gather human remains, did he?
No, interestingly, he didn't. Ernest Westlake was very interested in determining European human antiquity. And he wasn't a biologist. He wasn't interested in biological evolution. He was interested in cultural evolution, in the phases of culture. And he wanted to prove that Europeans dated back 100,000 years. And he had always been a geologist. Anthropology was a very new discipline for him, and he had very little knowledge about Tasmania. I guess one of the only things he would have known was this idea that they were extinct.
Okay, well, let's look at this notion of extinction. Even Darwin talked about the demise of the Tasmanians as the natural consequence of what happens when, quote, civilized nations come into contact with barbarians. But heavens above, the barbarians were on our side, in that the last Tasmanian, or the head of the bloke deemed to be the last Tasmanian, was taken to the Museum of London. And, of course, there's the sorry story of Truganinny.
Well, that's right. I mean, William Lanny's head was arranged, would be removed from his body by surgeons in Hobart, and yet it never surfaced in London. And it caused a huge controversy and was seen at the time as being controversial and very wrong by the British. Yet there is a kind of relishing of that superiority that happens at the same time. They are the last, and yet this is what happens when a superior race comes into contact. Truganinny comes after William Lanny. As the last man, they are inevitably doomed, it seems, and she is the very last of her race, it is seemed. The idea of the race is formed purely by the notion of Tasmania being separate from Australia. Yeah. It's a separate society, a separate race.
Now,
an
of course,
obsolete idea.
For our bloke, it was easier to collect the tools in Tasmania because they were pretty much on the surface. There was no need to dig down through the layers.
There wasn't. It was, ironically, the vast depth of antiquity of Aboriginal people that had left not only extremely deep and rich midden sites dating back thousands of years, but the extraordinary numbers of people has also had left large quarry sites and camping sites strewn with artifacts. And even if he hadn't been able to find them on the surface, he might have dug. In the few instances where he was encouraged to dig into a midden, he couldn't quite see the point. He didn't see, or even where he thought these middens suggest they've been here, even in vast numbers or for thousands of years, he wasn't looking for Aboriginal antiquity. He was looking for European antiquity. So he didn't even as he saw it, it didn't register.
My guest is Rebe Taylor. Her book is Into the Heart of Tasmania, A Search for Human Antiquity. And this is Fake Night Live on RN. Okay, Westlake travels around Tassie on a bicycle with a tent. How on earth did a bloke travelling so light manage to collect 13,000 or so rather heavy stones?
Well, he was pretty tenacious. He did load up his bike and make sometimes several trips from the remote farm or camping site that he was staying on. Sometimes, in some cases, in the wetter parts of the country, he would trudge barefoot and again over several days bring back the stones to the closest railway station. He would sometimes arrange for those boxes to then be shipped to Hobart. He left Tasmania in 1910 and paid a local amateur collector to ship them on his behalf. And that took several years, and as you can imagine, at vast cost.
Rebe, when introducing you, I made the point that you are every bit as interested in his diaries and letters, and you argue that these have been, well, discounted and misinterpreted by historians. Does that begin with the politics of the time?
Yes. What Westlake himself didn't see is that he was talking to Aboriginal people. He was talking to people he called half-castes and other people called half-castes, and they were not seen as authentic or full-blood or genuine. It's also the tide of history has passed, and so there's the possibility that Aboriginal people are speaking after their contact with white people. And anthropology that followed him, he himself was distrustful of what he'd found. He wasn't sure. He called it sweepings. His archive was not really examined until the 1960s by the archaeologist Rhys Jones, who was, in contrary to Westlake, looking for human antiquity in Tasmania.
Well, I'm glad you raised him, because that reminds me of the great controversy that swirled around Rhys Jones at the time, because a myth develops that the Aborigines were doomed because of, well, in a sense, backwardness, that they'd lost the ability to make fire. And if the fire stick went out, they were stuffed.
It's interesting that Rhys Jones is another very important and charismatic character, far more famous than Ernest Westlake, and to give him credit, has done far more contribution to the knowledge of Tasmanian Aboriginal archaeology and history. And in opposition to Westlake, he goes to search for this human antiquity and finds it. He finds that they are a people with a very deep past, and links Tasmania to the mainland. It sees that the Tasmanian Aborigines are not a separate race, as was assumed, that they had walked to their island and had one of the oldest cultures, continuing cultures. And yet he then says something that seems to contradict his ideas, his promotion of Tasmania, by saying that the island of Tasmania is itself heart-shaped, but it's cut off from the mainland. And in that sense, he sees the rising seas at the end of the last ice age, the last Pleistocene, as causing this disruption. This that they are, even if Abel Tasman had never sailed the seas, they were doomed to this slow strangulation of the mind, this loss of knowledge. And in many ways, there were deep problems with that theory. And I think Ernest Westlake's papers reveal that they could make fire. They tell him repeatedly how they did, and the settlers agree. And also
you're probably too young to remember the huge row that exploded around the Rhys Tater arguments.
I am too young to have been there, but I was very fortunate to be at the ANU at the same time as Rhys Jones, and only shortly before he passed away. And he, shortly after he found out that I was doing a PhD in Tasmanian Aborigines, he kind of cornered me in the beer garden, which was a favourite haunt of his. And he was a wonderful storyteller. And he called me over to the table and he said, I think I really need to tell you about that controversy. And during 2003, he and I had some many long conversations where he tried to explain to me his side of the story.
Did he feel that he'd been misunderstood and misinterpreted?
Deeply. He felt that, in his own words, I gave them their history, he said of the Aborigines. And I remember reflecting, thinking, this is spoken in a peak of anger. I need to be fair to him. And yet it's strikingly arrogant.
Yeah. And okay, let's go back to Ernest. He, in fact, talks to Aboriginal descendants and they talk to him. Now, to an unusual degree. Now, we've talked about him being tenacious, but you also think that he won people over because he was courteous.
I can only guess. Ernest Westlake seems full of contradictions. He's remembered by his own grandchildren as incredibly shy, almost without social niceties, incapable of communicating. And yet he starts an alternative Boy Scouts movement and dresses in a cloak and addresses large crowds later in life.
Yes.
He crosses seas to talk to people. Mm. I think because he arrives on the Bass Strait Islands to a community that is not only isolated but very protective of itself and its culture, and many researchers have come before him. Some have even been asked, offered money for language, and they've not given it on agreement, and yet they give him a wealth of information. And I think it's because he comes without institution, without title. He comes humble with probably quite plain clothing, and he's quite a shy person and probably quite respectful but very open-minded.
It's a very plausible argument you're mounting, I think. Now, he also spoke to pastoralists, all of whom expressed similar views of what the Tasmanian Aborigines were like, and I use the past tense here, and they described them to Westlake as peaceful until provoked by taking their women or killing them, surprise, surprise, and they acknowledged mistreatment. But the pastoralists, as reported by your bloke, say it was done by the British and not by them, not by the settlers.
Yes, there's this mantra, what a shame, what a terrible thing happened. It needs to be remembered. And yet it's never the very people who took away the vast tracts of land that caused the frontier conflict. The causes, the perpetrators are interestingly the British rulers, the Redcoats, those who opened fire at Risdon Cove in 1804. And they are the savage convicts, the whites gone bad. And they create an irrational Aboriginal people who were once harmless, have been made bad. And ultimately, it's the Aborigines who are to blame. They act up in this crazy way. And as one person said, the land was soaked in blood. And this is the repetition that goes through all these interviews. And yet there are small moments where it's revealed, as one person said, actually, the real reason they were killed was just to get them off the land.
Now, I'm looking at a photograph of Ernest as we speak. Quite a striking man. He's a handsome fellow.
He's 56 when he goes. He is in many ways the archetypal Victorian gentleman, isn't he? With his beard, his tidy hair. He would have dressed in very practical tweeds. He wasn't particularly interested in fashion. I think as a young man he wore sandals and loose-fitting clothing for comfort. And yes, he was although he had rejected his father's evangelical conservatism, he was still a Quaker. He wouldn't drink and would also not take meat or coffee or tea. He's quite distinct in that sense and very open-minded in his religious approach to spiritualism and the ability to communicate with ghosts in the afterlife.
Well, doesn't everyone? Now, Ernest didn't earn fame or fortune from his trip to Tasmania, but as you pointed out, he ended up finding a sort of fame in a different way with his, what was it, the Order of Woodcraft Chivalry, a peaceful version of the Scouts valuing woodcraft and survival skills. I like that.
Well, what we have to understand about him and all his various interests in life is that he is at heart an evolutionist, and he believes, although he was very sad about what happened in Tasmania, he thought it was a blot on otherwise a fantastic empire, he believed that the First World War was an example of industrialism gone far. What he saw in Tasmania and what he admired was the ability of Aboriginal people to camp in the bush, to live without excessive clothing, without all the trappings of civilization. And he's very inspired by Edward Carpenter, who similarly at the time says civilization is a disease and it's going to kill us. And the First World War was seen as a manifestation of that. Mm. And Ernest Westlake says, well, the only way we can go back to the type of strength that we would have had is to practice that culture. We need to not only remember the chivalric system that allowed us to hunt, we need to go back. Children need to begin in the caves. They need to learn their Paleolithic skills.
It's interesting, isn't it, that he probably found more friends in the 21st century than he found in his own. Look, congratulations. I understand you've now digitised all of Westlake's diaries and letters. So you've in fact providing an amazing resource to the next generation, especially for the descendants of the people he spoke to.
Look, thank you very much. And without their assistance and guidance, I could not have begun to understand the wealth of his papers or to have written this book.
Rebe Taylor, Dr. Rebe Taylor, author of Into the Heart of Tasmania, published by MUP. A pleasure and a privilege, Rebe, and you're going to get the first koala stamp for the year.
Thank you so much, Philip. It's been a pleasure.